Hello and welcome to an Easter edition of Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. This week, writer and editor Christopher Potter takes us on a history of the universe and also tells us what he's learned from editing some of the most popular science books of all time. We'll talk about how big business is suddenly getting concerned about environment, why NASA is feeling headless, and I'll take you on a tour of some very rare seeds. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome to our listeners and to our pod members, Ian Sample, our science correspondent, and David Adams, environment correspondent. They're both here. Hello, chaps. Are you looking forward to weekend?
Hi, Alok.
Not because the weekend's already happened. The weekend's already happened. But if you were hypothetically looking forward to weekend.
Really refreshed now.
Really?
Yeah.
Good. Excellent. Well, from that professional beginning, our guest this week is Christopher Potter, a former mathematician. His most recent career was finding and editing some of the most popular science books in the past few decades, including Darvis Sabell's Longitude and Simon Singh's Fermat's Last Theorem. He's also worked on books by celebrated novelists Annie Proulx and Carol Shields. His latest book, this time written by himself, is A History of the Universe. Christopher, hello and welcome.
Thank you.
Now, A History of the Universe, it's something that you could probably write endlessly on, and many people probably have tried. Why did you tackle this subject? Where did it start?
Well, I think I have to say, first of all, that I'm not really a mathematician. I had read mathematics 30 years ago, and then I did 1 year course in history and philosophy of science.
I guarantee you're more of a mathematician than anyone else in this room, so in that context.
Yeah. But I suppose it was doing the history and philosophy of science course that really sort of piqued my interest. And in the subsequent years as a publisher, I suppose I was lucky that I was able to publish things that interested me. So as well as publishing novels and history and all that sort of thing, I was able to publish science writers that I just liked and lucky to be able to talk to them about science. But I always thought there was a gap in the market. And I suppose for about 25 years, I thought I was going to find someone to write the book that I wanted someone to write, which was really a book about what science is doing when science does what it does. And so I suppose ultimately I thought, well, I better do it myself, because it's obvious after 25 years that no one else is going to do it. And I thought the universe was actually an interesting way of writing about the whole of what science is. And I was really writing it for skeptical friends who... I mean, when we talk about skeptics, we usually think of people who are skeptical about God and religion. But I think a lot of people, certainly I know, are sort of skeptical about materialism. They just don't want to perhaps they don't even really want to know about it. So I really wanted to start from absolute basics. Well, what is it that we do as scientists when we do science? And I think really it starts from the position of, well, we're here looking out on a world of things that are moving. And it's as simple as that. And so from there, we sort of have to ask, well, what are things made out of and what do we mean by motion?
So this isn't a social history of science, though. It's not a situation where people are discovering what science is and what the scientific method is. It's more, but you're taking people from the very smallest things to the very biggest things. And you're holding people's hands along that way. So what was... In your research, when you started this book, did you have to start from scratch and learn all of this? Or did you kind of have a knowledge from the books you'd already edited and read?
I think I did start from a rather hubristic position of thinking I knew a lot more than I actually did. And then I thought, oh, God, I don't really know very much at all. So I spent about 2 years just reading.
What did you read?
Very good question. Well, I reread a lot of the books that actually published. So Matt Ridley's books on genome, various books on genome. And I sort of selected a few books in each area, and Peter Forbes on genetics, and obviously Dawkins and sort of the familiar names.
Take us through the process then. So you started from scratch, essentially.
Yeah.
And then how did you decide how you're going to order the book, how you're going to...
Well, I wrote a proposal that turned out to be completely different from how the book turned out to be, because I thought, well, I don't know if I can even really write sort of joined up narrative. So I had this idea that I was going to have a line of time going from the Big Bang to now, or to perhaps even to the end of time. And then a space line from the smallest thing, sort of Planck length, to the edge of, you know, the furthest that light has traveled in the time that the universe has been going. And then I would sort of put things along it, and then I'd write sort of notes in between. And it was sort of a crazy idea, and of course it didn't work at all. And then I spent, as I began thinking about that and reading, a sort of structure emerged that I would sort of start, as you say, by sort of guiding nervous readers by the hand and start from where we are human-sized in the universe and go out gradually by orders of 10 and see how far we get. And then that gets us to sort of superclusters of galaxies and quasars. And then I go from there and say, well, actually, having structures revolving around common centers of gravity isn't something we just sort of discover by moving out. In fact, the universe comes to us. You know, we've discovered it by our understanding of light, mostly. And so then I go through a sort of history of how we came to understand what motion is. And that really takes me back to the beginning of culture and then through Newton and up to Einstein. And then I start going the other direction to the smallest things and quantum physics. And then I sort of join the two in the middle of the book and start the universe off. And then I go through all of time from that point, and that takes us through evolution to now. So that's sort of basically how.
So I'm not sure how you got all of that into a few hundred pages, but
I was going to say, if you're writing about all that, the problem is less where to start than where to stop, isn't it?
I knew I wanted to keep it short, so I don't dwell too much on how the experiments actually work. I'm much more interested in what the result of them is. So I'm much more interested in the ideas.
I mean, out of those ideas, you've got the whole of knowledge, essentially, human knowledge, to sort of pick from. Which of the ideas are the ones you ended up dwelling on the most, or the ones that you found most interesting to talk about for your sceptical audience?
Well, I liked the actually going back to the beginning of history, because, of course, the Greeks had all the ideas already and understood what the essential problem is. And if you're going to describe the universe, then ultimately you have to describe how something came from nothing. And the Greeks got round it by saying, well, in fact, there isn't nothing. The clue is actually in the word, how we use it. There are no things called chaos. It's a pre-existing state in which there's no order. And then one comes along with logos, order, word, knowledge, and that's applied to this pre-existing state of chaos. And out of it are created named things, and that is order or beauty, which is the Greek word cosmos, which we also use for cosmetics. And so modern science still has to somehow come along with an idea of how something comes from nothing. And the interesting thing is, as we look at the particulate nature of things, well, things are made of something else. Well, how small can they get? Well, it's in a way not surprising, because that would be an infinite regression unless we came up with some other idea about the nature of the smallest things. And that's that actually it turns out not to be about size. It turns out to be about energy. And so this odd thing happens when we're looking at the universe. We look at these horizons down to the smallest things and out to the largest things, and it's the same place. As we look at the smallest things, you have to put more and more energy into the vacuum, and you recreate more and more the conditions that pertained at the beginning of the universe. And as you look out to the most distant things, you're looking also to how the universe, the sort of echo of that beginning.
Just hearing you talk about the scope of the book, I mean, it sounds quite a head-melting exercise to have gone through. I just wonder if you were you different? Did it change you coming out the other side of this project?
I was slightly scared in a way that, you know, it might even make one slightly crazy thinking, because I think in a way that is why we don't think about these things too much, and that as children we're probably more aware of the peculiarity of our position of being alive, you know, because we don't really have many memories, and we're sort of inclined to think, well, where is it that we came from? And we can't really get our head around it, which is why I sort of started the book writing, which is something I did as a child, writing out my address and going out from sort of Britain to the solar system and galaxies and the universe, because I think we don't really know how we sort of fit in to everything or nothing. And so those are our great fears. And we also know that Freud has a lot to say about how fear of death and things makes us who we are. I think the suppressing of that plays a large part in what we become as people.
So what is our address then, to as specific as you can make it now?
It's a real test of my memory, isn't it? Well, the one I wrote about was my childhood address, which I can remember the early bits of it, which is 225 Rush Green Road, Lyme, Cheshire, well, England, I should say, the UK, Europe, the world, the Earth, the solar system. We have to do the Milky Way. Then we do the local group. which has to be a sort of joke, really, doesn't it? They called it the local group, which is a group of small group of galaxies, Andromeda and a few others. And then the supercluster, which is called...
Oh, God, no.
What is it called?
Sagittarius.
It is Sagittarius, yes. Yeah. It's not very many structures, and suddenly you're at the...
Well, then you've got another one, universe, and then which multiverse you're in.
I know, exactly.
As well. Yeah.
So in a way, the universe doesn't mean the universe anymore, and that's how science proceeds, because you always have to compare something to something else. So you would think, well, how can you compare a universe to something else when it's everything? Well... because we don't think it's everything, ultimately, I suppose. And so we mathematically model universes on computers. And so then we have to come up with some other word, like parallel universes or multiverse. Or
I was only going to say, it reminded me of when I read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, there was it's a terrible torture device called the Infinite Perspective Machine or the Total Perspective Machine, which is a room where people were placed and they were shown their absolute insignificance in the great scheme of the cosmos and the universe. Yes. And it just... reminding me a little bit of that.
I think some of our politicians need that. do you think that you approach this sort of set of knowledge, this idea of where the universe is and all of that, differently to the way a scientist might? Because, again, a scientist who studies cosmology would have to think about this technically, but really they're not really thinking about where the universe came from in a philosophical sense, but literally what were the particles, what was the energy?
Yeah.
And do you think that's a level of a way of abstracting yourself from those slightly scary questions which you were trying to tackle?
Yes, well, Feynman actually made the point brilliantly that he said that if one scientist is unlikely to ask another scientist a philosophical question because he knows the response will be shut up and calculate.
Feynman was no fan of philosophy, though.
No.
He didn't like anything where there was no experimental evidence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you understand why now? Can you understand now why no one has written that book in the 25 years?
I can rather. Yeah.
I mean, actually, as coming on to that, as an editor yourself, was it easy to move to writing, or were you? I mean, I'm curious, who would want to edit you? Because that would be something that would be quite scary to do in itself.
Yes, actually, my editor did leave almost immediately after buying the book, so I don't know if that had something to do with it. I think that was why I was sort of clumsily wrote that proposal, that I could pretend it wasn't really a book and that I could pretend I wasn't really going to be a writer. And I kept thinking as I was writing the book, oh God, I've got to pay the money back. I better not spend it. I'll just keep it in an account separately for when I have to tell them that I can't do this. And then when I got the structure and worked out what I actually wanted to say, then the odd thing was I forgot about all those things. I was too busy writing it. Which I suppose is a bit like scientists. They're too busy doing what they do to be interested in what it is that they're doing when they do what they do. But I am interested in that, and I think a lot of people are not interested in science. Well, artists who are not interested in science, they're not interested in the actual nitty-gritty that scientists do. They want to understand perhaps a bit more about that sort of what underlies that process. And I think it's interesting what you were saying about feeling absolutely insignificant in the universe, because the odd thing is that we're either insignificant or we're everything. We're sort of, and that's... this whole sort of thing that started with Copernicus, you know, sort of removing the Earth and putting the Sun there, well, then it's not... then you have to remove the Sun and it's something else, and then it's consciousness, and is it the end of some sort of chain of evolution? That seems to be how science progresses. We're either absolutely nothing or we're everything. We don't seem to be anything in between. But that's... I don't think that reflects the actuality of... the experience of being human. That's the methodology of science. That's actually how it proceeds, and I think that's interesting.
But if we're in the middle, then what's at either end?
The horizon. It's just as far as we can see to our knowledge of who we are. I mean, if you were an atom, the horizon would no doubt look very different.
Well, it all sounds very interesting. Chris, thank you very much. You Are Here, A Portable History of the Universe is out now, published by Hutchinson. Let's now look at some of the science stories this week. Ian and David, take us through the news jam.
News jam.
Business leaders have attacked the government's environmental policy, arguing that ministers are not doing enough to cut global warming emissions or make sure the UK does not run out of power. The CBI says billions of pounds of necessary investment will move to the US and China unless the government takes urgent action. It comes amid widespread disappointment that the G20 heads of state failed to come up with any real push on green issues as part of a £743 billion financial aid package for the global economy.
A leading industry figure has told The Guardian that Barack Obama's failure to appoint a new chief to run NASA is fostering an atmosphere of anxiety and uncertainty. The space agency has been without a head since Michael Griffin stepped down in January, amid newspaper reports of heated arguments with the president's transition team, which Griffin has denied. Obama's intended candidate for the job was blocked by opponents on Capitol Hill. NASA is now facing fundamental questions about its future, with only 8 space shuttle flights left on the books and a retirement date for the entire fleet penned in for next year.
Cancer Research UK has warned that one woman in her 20s is being diagnosed with the most serious form of skin cancer almost every day. Malignant melanoma, which can be fatal, is on the rise and is being boosted by sunbed use and binge tanning on foreign holidays. There are almost twice as many melanoma cases as breast cancers among women in their 20s, even though melanoma is largely avoidable, though the number of diagnoses is rising in all age groups.
And finally, after 10 years of daring adventure in some of the most remote parts of the world, botanists from Kew Gardens in London have reached their target of collecting seeds from 10% of the world's flowering plants. Around 30,000 species, including some of the rarest plants in the world, are represented in Kew Gardens' deep storage facility, ready to be grown in case any of them becomes extinct.
David, Ian, thank you both very much. Let's talk about a couple of those. David, that first story about the CBI, the Confederation of British Industry, lambasting the government about its carbon targets and so on. Is it a surprise that companies are doing this? You know, the industry sort of saying to the government that you know, they're not doing enough.
Well, the CBI has become increasingly vocal on this issue in the last few years. I think the consistent line from business is that business wants certainty. It doesn't want, well, we might do this or we might do that or we're going to try and do this and see what happens. They like to know what's going to happen over the next, certainly, political cycle, 7, 8, 10, maybe even 20 years, because that's the way they plan their investment. I think it does seem a little bit disingenuous, perhaps, that businesses are sort of asking the government to take action on climate change, which is inevitably going to involve regulation of many businesses. And I think certainly behind the scenes, a lot of the companies that the CBI represents would probably say different things to the government and are lobbying the government in different ways. But I think as a collective, I think the CBI have quite a powerful voice, and it does put a bit more pressure on the government.
Well, the problem that the government has surely is that it can't make certainty on climate targets and so on without negotiating with the rest of the world. So the negotiations that are going to happen at the end of this year in Copenhagen are going to set lots of things for the next 20 or 30 years. Is that a good enough excuse for the government to say to the business, look, we can't make plans for the next 50 years, or can they?
Well, in this criticism, they were being quite specific. They were talking about investment in renewable energy. Britain has got a European target to generate a fifth of all of its energy from renewable sources within a decade or so. And I think the CBI is warning that the conditions just aren't very favourable for that investment.
So they need special market conditions, basically?
Whether they need special market conditions or they just need, there's a lot of mess that needs clearing up. We've got a very old national grid. We've got planning problems. So if you're a company and you're going to invest millions, hundreds of millions of pounds, say in a wind farm, you might be better building it in Germany or Denmark or the US than in Britain at the moment. And that's the issue they're trying to address.
Okay, well, let's move across the pond. Ian, Obama's been good at everything so far as we're concerned in science, but he's kind of left NASA dangling a little bit.
He has, but in a way, you can think of it as, well, NASA is working quite well, so it's not a top priority. I mean, he's still got Treasury appointments to make, and, you know, if one thing that needs sorting out around the world, it's the economy. So those things are going to be high priority. He's had the G20, he's had Afghanistan, a hell of a lot of stuff that was going to be higher up the in-tray.
Are you saying the backlash against Obama does not start here?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, go on.
But what's interesting, though, is that this is a really tricky time for NASA. I mean, their previous chief administrator, Mike Griffin, a Bush appointee, it's a political position, stepped down in January. He didn't want to go. There was a family and friends petition to Obama pleading to keep him on, which was quite... those things never work, and they're obviously quite embarrassing things to happen. But
he was pretty good.
Yeah, he was well regarded, definitely. I mean, he and there are all manner of reports about him having huge bust ups with the transition team, which came in and was all over all the projects to look at what was going on. But what's interesting is you have Obama coming out with a budget last month, saying it's not the full budget, but it's kind of a rough stage budget, saying, look, NASA's going to get an extra billion for the year ahead. It's also going to get $1 billion extra from the stimulus package. So he's endorsing, you know, NASA and doing exploration of space. But what he also said is that there's a sense of drift at NASA that's got to be addressed, and that what NASA needs is a vision for the 21st century. So on one hand, he's saying, yeah, it's all great, but he's saying, if things aren't going quite well, we need something big. And talking to people in the industry, the sort of hope is he's inherited this Moon and Mars program from two generations of Bushes. What does he now go for in the current financial climate? And I think people are really hoping that he's going to sort out this problem that they have when the shuttle is grounded from next year and they need to work on a replacement, and just say, look, let's go to the moon, let's do a moon base. And I think he has come out with something which is a very clear and robust and manageable project that isn't going to completely bust the budget.
The moon project, the idea of getting back to the moon by 2020, which was, you know, gloriously announced by George W. In 2003, was it 2002 maybe even? It was a massive political sort of signpost. It's like we're being exploratory and so on, and you can kind of understand why the new administration would want to distance themselves from anything in George Bush's regime. But is there any indication that program will be cut back? Is there anything saying that actually that Obama might focus on other things like climate change monitoring or anything like that that NASA does also very well?
No, they're going to put money into Earth observation and stuff like that, but at the same time, really encouragingly, I think they are, all the signs are they're not going to cut back on the human space program at all. Griffin used to despair that the sum total of human exploration in space was what he would refer to as essentially spinning around Earth in a can. And he thought, you know, 40, 50 years on from the Apollo program, we should be far more advanced than that. He talked about going to Lagrangian points, going to near-Earth objects. And he did want to get on course going to the Moon and Mars. It's almost the only thing you can do if you're going to be progressive.
Who's in the frame for the chief administrator then, just quickly?
Well, the candidates change literally week by week. I mean, I think I've counted at least half a dozen that have come and gone. The original candidate, Scott Gratian, ex-fighter pilot, was knocked down by Capitol Hill. Now you've got this guy, Chris Scalese, the acting administrator, who might be in with a chance. There's also two former astronauts.
I'm going to move on now to the Millennium Seed Bank at Kew. This is the project started 10 years ago by Kew Gardens to collect rare seeds from around the world. It wanted to collect 10% of the world's seeds by 2010, and it's well ahead of schedule. The personal thing I like about this most, though, it's the source of one of my most favourite assignments I ever had at The Guardian. I wasn't even here for a year before I was sent to Lebanon to accompany through two botanists who were driving around the mountains looking for seeds, essentially. And they'd be like, suddenly the car would screech to a halt. There's a flower over there. They'd run over to it, to try and sort of extract the seeds from this thing. They spent 2 days tracking one particular flower. I still remember the name, the Iris sophorana, which they couldn't find in the end. But there've been rumours of the farmers had told them there were fields of this stuff somewhere. They went for days looking at this. And if I ever write a novel, this will be the subject of my novel. It was the most amazing 2 days. Beautiful people, beautiful food, beautiful country, and also a great night out in Beirut.
Well, I think we should get Chris's views on whether that will be a good novel.
You can still find it on the Guardian website. It's called On the Road with the Plant Hunters. I wanted to make it out as if it was some sort of Indiana Jones type thing.
You might
fantastic.
Need to spread it out for more than 2 days if you're going to turn it into a novel.
It could be a psychological thriller. How about that? Anyway, a lot more of that stuff. The seed bank story, actually, there's a whole gallery of beautiful seed pictures at guardian.co.uk/science, and you can read more about Ian's NASA piece at guardian.co.uk/science, and also some of the environment stuff at guardian.co.uk/environment.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Let's hear some feedback from listeners. We've not had this for a little while. On Chris French and skepticism, Sunwarm has to say,
great to hear a skeptic joining the science team. For my money, the rise in skepticism derives from the rise in misinformation being taken up by the public at large, especially in the areas of health and medicine. A very fine blog, Science-Based Medicine, is discussing right now the practice by some med schools of requiring students to take part in rotations of dubious medical value, such as acupuncture. It's only because so much magical thinking is being introduced into our culture that skeptics have felt the need to become more vocal.
Booker Matsey says,
"So, some skepticism is allowed in Science Weekly. All is not lost. Too bad climate change skeptics don't get the same respect. Your ongoing discussion on what you should call climate change skeptics is quite demeaning to you. Why don't you debate them instead of calling them names? You have not won the argument."
Commenting on our News Jam story about the newly hatched chicks that can do maths, Lacan Ardnoir tweeted,
"I hear the maths tests for newly hatched chicks are being dumbed down, though."
Very good. You can comment on the Facebook wall, of course, and also on our Twitter feed. You can find the links on our blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Now, one more thing before we get back to talking to Chris. On the blog this week, Ian, you wrote about words and phrases that have been adopted by scientists after they've first appeared in science fiction. Tell us why, where you got this from.
That's right. There's a guy called Jeff Prucher, or Prucher, who's the editor of Oxford English Dictionary's Science Fiction Project. And he'd written a blog about listing his 9 favourite words that are in common usage in science that have you can trace back to science fiction. And so there was robotics coming from Asimov's Liar in 1941. There was zero-G from Arthur C. Clarke's Islands in the Sky in 1952. And I just thought there was this was an interesting thing that I should note. People out there thought that there might be other words lurking in science fiction which haven't quite made it into the actual science lexicon yet. And I mean, one thing that I noticed about Jeff's blog post was that the latest example he had was from 1975, or certainly mid-70s. I thought there must, you know, science fiction is alive and well, as far as I'm aware, as a genre. And I thought there must be far more words coming out. So I just really wanted to pick the brains of people out there, because I'm not too much of a science fiction expert.
Well, looking at some of the comments on Jeff Prusher's actual original blog post, he had 9 things, of which, by the way, one of them was genetic engineering, which turns out someone pointed out to him had been used by scientists before they appeared in novels, and he sort of corrected himself. But there were other ones like ion drive, deep space, pressure suit. But in the comments, there were words like cyberspace, of course, in William Gibson's Neuromancer novel. Mm. Other things like avatar. What were the ones that you came up with as well for the future?
Well, I'm a bit embarrassed to talk about mine because they weren't from science fiction. They were just sort of from knocking around in a pretty sort of boring part of my head. But so I thought, well, I wrote this very quickly, okay, so I didn't spend an awful lot of time thinking about it because I knew that things that the readers would have would be far more interesting. But so there was every future in science fiction is dystopian. So there's obviously going to be a lot of depression around. So I thought, well, obviously you'll need a disc pill. And disc being, disc 1 was a gene that was identified last year as being linked with manic depression. And so the disc 1 pill would obviously make sure that you kept jolly. The other thing I had was a Higgs drive, which probably doesn't need too much explanation.
I'm not sure what a Higgs drive would
do. Well, the problem with the Higgs drive is you kind of only come up with the idea if you're a bit stupid, because so the Higgs field, as far as we know, is something that confers mass on elementary particles in the universe. So we're talking about quarks and electrons that make up atomic nuclei and, you know, building blocks of matter. So if you can have my idea of this Higgs drive would be something that could actually cancel out the Higgs field around an object.
Make it weightless.
Well, the idea is that it would make it massless. So you can then sort of just give it a flick and all of a sudden you'll be at work. Or, you know, you can move things around. It's like an anti-gravity thing. But there is a big problem with it, because almost all of the mass of an atom doesn't come from the mass of the constituents. So you can get rid of the mass of the quark and the electron, and an atomic nuclei, neutron and proton, will still weigh pretty much the same, because most of the mass comes from the energy of those things binding together rather than the actual mass of constituents.
You mean the force particles?
That's right, gluon, yeah. Energy. Yeah.
The question I have for you is, though, that if something doesn't have mass, do the laws of physics work on it? Because there's nothing for gravity to grab onto, so actually it doesn't exist.
I don't even understand that question.
That's a philosophical question. Well, think about it. The second law of...
Say it to me again,
slowly.
Newton's
second law of force equals mass times acceleration. If there's zero mass, there's no acceleration either, or force, for that matter. It wouldn't move.
But you're using, like, Newtonian physics on something which is to do with quantum theory.
Should work, though. If I put you in a Higgs field... Mass
what, like
machine.
It works on, like,
let's
it
not
works
talk
on
about
some
this.
Atomic
I think
particles.
Alex just stumbled across the unified theory.
Christopher, can I? What do you think? Are there words that you've come from science fiction or from science you like?
this is slightly not relevant, but it just makes me think of it because I love this while I was researching the book that we know the quark thing is a very familiar story. You know, it comes from Finnegan's Wake, the sound a seagull makes in the novel. But there was a competing theory at the time that Feynman came up with, and he had a similar sort of particle, and he was going to call his particle the parton, after Dolly Parton. And I thought, Dolly Parton, wow, she gets to have both parts of her name are used in science, because Dolly the sheep was also named after her because it was cloned from breast flesh. So I thought, I'll throw that in.
That's superb. Superb. Quark is actually my favourite one. Joyce, Finnegan's Wake, James Joyce. Is it pronounced quark or quark?
I say both.
Okay, well, let's have some more examples on our blog. Listen out there, but let's go back to Chris now before we wind up. Chris, you've edited, as I said earlier, Simon Singh, Dava Sobel. What sort of attracted you to those two books? I mean, Fermat's Last Theorem by Simon Singh and Longitude by Dava Sobel are two of the most celebrated science books in the last, you know, 15 years.
Longitude was actually turned down by every publisher in London twice.
Well, there's a good story. Tell us about that. Tell us about the Harry Potter of science books.
Well, I was in New York, and I was there, and it was just coming out in New York, and I don't know if this is a bit of a cheat, but I could see that it was getting a bit of attention there, and I thought, well, hang on a minute. This is a sort of key story of our history. Surely it should be. So I asked to see it. Fourth State, which was where I worked, was a tiny company at the time, and actually we hadn't been sent it, so we weren't one of the companies that had turned it down. But I didn't pay very much for it, so I wasn't taking much of a risk. But the day we published it, there was a serial, and part of it was serialized in the Daily Telegraph. And when we got back to the office on Monday, our whole print run, 10,000 copies, had been ordered by readers of the Daily Telegraph. So we knew something interesting was happening at that point. And then having got that book, well, it was actually number one for, I think, 2 years. It sold over 1 million copies. And then I saw that program, the Horizon program that Simon Singh did on Fermat, and I just thought, you know, I thought it would be a good book.
Awaken the mathematician inside you.
Yeah. Yeah, and I couldn't really remember that there'd ever been a number one maths bestseller. I thought it was time there was. So.
Were you secretly pleased that you managed to get maths at the top of the...
Hugely excited, yeah. I mean, that was one of the fun things about the job when the company was really small, that, you know, I could just publish things that particularly fired my excitement. So I think I was very lucky because, as you said, I also got to publish people like Annie Proulx and Brokeback Mountain and Shipping News, those sorts of books in totally different sort of areas.
What was it particularly about Longitude, though, that you think, you say it was turned down quite a lot by publishers, but what was it about that book that you think made it work so well?
I think it's because we suddenly realised we had a hero, John Harrison, that no one had ever heard of before, and he had been hugely influential. In a way, he'd sort of saved the Navy, you know, all these ships were going off course and lives were being lost, and I think it was something people could understand. You know, there have been all these various attempts to try and work out how to measure longitude, some of them ridiculous and some of them to do with how one sort of looked at the stars and things. But his was actually very straightforward. It was actually how to make a watch that worked well on board a ship. So it was about making things, which I think people liked too. And you could go and see them. The attendance at Greenwich doubled after the book came out.
Featured in Only Fools and Horses, wasn't it? That's how they got rich, because they found one in the back of these.
What were they called? H4 or something. One of the models in his garage.
Yeah. Yeah. Full of trivia, David. It's incredible.
It was the very last episode, yeah, too.
Our very own example here is about to start writing his own popular science book about particle physics. What advice have you got for him to make it into a bestseller?
Write about something else.
Yeah. Don't do it.
Write about food or celebrities instead.
What's the thing that makes a science book good?
I think passion, ultimately. I think books that really work are the ones where writers feel that they absolutely have to write the book, but they may not even know why they have to write it until after they've written it. And, you know, I'm not saying that mine's a particularly great book, but I didn't really know why I wanted to write the book. But I knew I sort of had to write it. I sort of was fed up of the sort of what you were talking about earlier, the sort of how skeptics are only allowed to be skeptics of religion, that no one's ever allowed to be skeptical of materialism. And it's not that I doubt what it is. I mean, it's, in some ways, it's the most successful thing we've ever done as human beings. But I think one's allowed to be open-minded about it.
Okay, well, Chris, thank you very much for coming in and taking us through some of that. Chris's book, You Are Here, A Portable History of the Universe, is out now. Thanks to him and to my studio guests, David Adam and Ian Sample. Until next week, I'm Alok Jha. The programme is produced by Scott Cawley. Thanks for listening.